We'll see you next time.
Okay, let's unpack this. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is arguably one of the most fundamental in all of industrial history. We were taking a deep dive into the steam engine. This is the piece of technology that literally built the modern world, transitioning us from, you know, muscle power to mechanical might in what feels like the blink of a historical eye.
It really is the essential infrastructure, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's often just relegated to a history textbook. We see these images of, like, massive clanking locomotives or old Victorian factories, and we think of it as obsolete. But the core concept, this external combustion heat engine that uses pressurized steam to perform work, is still the single most important technology in large-scale global power generation.
Absolutely. If you turn on a light switch pretty much anywhere in the developed world, you are almost certainly relying on the descendants of the steam engine.
You are.
And I think that's a crucial distinction we need to make right out of the gate. We're talking about an external combustion engine. It's not like the internal combustion engine in your car. So what does that separation mean thermodynamically and, you know, practically?
Well, practically, it just means the entire system is segmented. You have a furnace or some kind of heat source where the fuel burns, but the combustion products, the smoke, the hot gases, they never actually enter the cylinder.
Right.
The working fluid, which is just water converted to steam, stays completely separate. It often works in a closed loop. That steam pressure then pushes a piston back and forth, what we call reciprocating motion, and that force is converted into rotational work.
Through a connecting rod and a crankshaft.
Exactly.
And when we look at the physics of how that happens, especially in its most idealized, most efficient form, we are talking about the Rankine cycle.
The Rankine cycle is the thermodynamic law. It governs virtually every modern high-output power station today. It's the theoretical underpinning that defines the whole process, turning water into steam, using that steam to do work, and then condensing it back into water to start the cycle all over again.
So it's the unifying principle.
It is. It's what connects a really cumbersome Ducommun engine from 1712 with a gigawatt nuclear reactor today.
So the mission is clear. We're tracing this revolutionary idea from its origins, analyzing the critical mechanical problems that engineers solved over three centuries, and explaining why, despite being replaced in cars and trains, it remains indispensable. If the Rankine cycle is the goal, where did this slow evolution of heat and pressure even begin?
It began with demonstration, not really application. We have to go way back. We have to start with the ancients. The first recorded instance of any machine powered by steam is Hero of Alexandria's Aeolipile in the first century AD.
Ah, right. That's often described as just a novelty, isn't it? Like a parlor trick.
Exactly. It was a remarkable piece of engineering for its time, but don't get me wrong. It was essentially this hollow sphere mounted on pivots. Steam was fed into it, and two jets expelled the steam tangentially, which made the sphere rotate. And rotate rapidly.
So it was a kind of reaction turbine.
A very rudimentary one, yes. Mm. It was used to demonstrate the potential of steam pressure, but it was never intended to do actual useful work. It was a curiosity that then basically vanished from the record for well over 1,000 years.
So the idea of steam power was there, but the economic and engineering pressures just weren't in place until much, much later. What brought it back into the practical conversation?
One single problem. Water. Specifically, water filling up mines. As mining tech improved and shafts went deeper, traditional methods like, you know, bucket chains pulled by horses or just manual labor became completely unsustainable.
They hit a wall.
They hit a wall. And we see early attempts to solve this, like Geronimo de Ayans y Beaumont's patented steam-powered water pump in 1606. It was designed specifically for draining inundated copper and silver mines in Spain. So that establishes the economic driver.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't drain the mine, you can't get the resource.
And the high demand for coal, the very fuel used to power these engines, just made the problem worse, forcing deeper and deeper shafts. This need for deep pumping power brings us to the first commercially viable engine.
That would be Thomas Avery, who patented his miner's friend in 1698. This was the first true commercial device, though, you know, we hesitate to call it an engine in the modern sense because it had no piston.
So how did it work without a piston? How did Savory's pump actually function?
It relied purely on pressure and vacuum. Savory would introduce steam into a chamber, then he'd quickly condense that steam by just cooling the outside of the chamber. That created a powerful vacuum inside. This vacuum would suck the water up from the mine shaft into the chamber.
Okay, so that's the first lift.
That's the first lift. Then a fresh charge of high-pressure steam would be introduced, and it would press directly down on the surface of the water to force it up to the surface.
It sounds incredibly simple and elegant, which is probably why the sources noted it was pretty cheap to build.
Cheap, yes, but very dangerous and severely limited. Because the steam pressure was applied directly to the water, the walls of that vessel had to be incredibly strong to prevent rupture.
And the suction part has a physical limit, right?
It does. The limit of a suction pump is only about 30 feet, regardless of how strong your vacuum is. So for deeper lifts, Savory had to rely purely on steam pressure and the early boilers. Well, they were prone to violent explosions.
So it was just too dangerous and too weak for the main application. It proved the concept, but that was it. Who stepped in to make it safe and successful?
That takes us to Thomas Newcomen, around 1712, with his famous atmospheric engine. And this wasn't just an improvement. It was a fundamental shift in mechanism. Newcomen introduced a massive beam and a piston and cylinder, transforming that simple pump into a true engine capable of continuous work.
And the sources really emphasize that the name, the atmospheric engine, is the key to understanding how it worked. It wasn't powered by expanding steam pushing the piston.
Absolutely. Vital point. Newcomen only used steam to facilitate the power stroke. He would fill this massive cylinder with low-pressure steam, then inject cold water directly into the cylinder itself.
Okay, so that instantly condenses the steam.
Instantly. It creates a near-perfect vacuum under the piston, and the actual working force was just normal atmospheric pressure, about 14.7 pounds per square inch, pushing the piston down into that vacuum.
So the atmosphere did the work. Newcomen just created the condition for the atmosphere to act.
Precisely. It was air pressure doing the heavy lifting, which is why these early engines required enormous cylinders just to get a usable amount of force. But the success was immediate and huge. Newcomen's engine worked at greater depths and more safely than Savory's. It quickly spread across the coal fields of Britain and Europe.
But it had that fundamental self-inflicted thermal wound.
Oh, the coal consumption was outrageous. To condense the steam, you sprayed cold water into the cylinder, cooling the cylinder walls. Then, on the very next stroke, you had to reintroduce hot steam, which then had to reheat those massive cold metal walls. This cyclical heating and cooling wasted colossal amounts of heat energy in every single stroke.
And that inefficiency was the technological ceiling for decades, until James Watt, starting in the 1760s, tackled that specific thermal flaw. This is the Watt Revolution. What was the aha moment for him?
Well, the legend goes that Watt was repairing a model of a Newcomen engine and just became fixated on how much steam it wasted. His core insight was simple but genius. Why cool down the very thing you're trying to keep hot? The cylinder should always be kept hot.
So how did he manage condensation without cooling the cylinder?
His solution was the separate condenser, which he patented in 1769. He piped the spent steam out of the working cylinder into a separate cooled vessel just for condensation. The main cylinder stayed hot, maintained by a steam jacket, while the condensation happened somewhere else.
Which meant the engine was no longer wasting all that heat reheating the cylinder walls over and over again.
Tens of thousands of times a day, yes.
And the immediate economic impact of that change is what really accelerated everything. We have the numbers. Bolton and Watt's engines used half the coal of the best Newcomen designs.
Look at Watt's own measurement of efficiency, which he called duty. An average Newcomen engine delivered about 5 million foot-pounds of work per unit of coal. Watt's early engines, they averaged 17 million, a threefold improvement. This wasn't just better physics. It was a revolutionary business model. In places where coal was expensive, Watt's engine was profitable. Where a Newcomen engine would bankrupt you, they even leveraged this. Bolton and Watt sold engines on credit and often took a share of the fuel savings as payment. They weaponized efficiency.
A brilliant blend of engineering and finance. But Watt's initial engines, like Newcomen's, were still primarily massive, stationary pumping engines. To truly revolutionize manufacturing, he needed rotary motion.
That was the next major hurdle. They had this powerful back-and-forth pumping action. But to drive factory lathes and looms, they needed continuous, smooth, circular motion. Wyatt was initially constrained by James Pickard's patent on the simple crank and flywheel.
So Watt had to invent a workaround.
He did. He famously used the sun and planet gear, which achieved rotary motion without violating the patent. But more importantly, he added other critical features. The double-acting cylinder, where steam pushes the piston in both directions, and the centrifugal governor to control speed. The result was an engine that could provide continuous, dependable rotary power, freeing factories from having to be located next to a river.
And that's the moment the Industrial Revolution truly scales up, when the factory can move inland. But Watt's patents, as beneficial as they were, also acted as a ceiling, particularly on pressure.
Watt was fundamentally afraid of high-pressure steam. He viewed it as dangerously unstable, so his patents legally prevented anyone from building high-pressure engines until they expired in 1800. The moment that ceiling lifted, the engineering world was ready for the next big shift.
Which was mobility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Enter Richard Trevithick in Britain and Oliver Evans in America. They realized that if you could use steam at high enough pressures, say 40 to 50 PSI, the steam itself could provide the driving force. No massive vacuum vessel, no huge cylinder needed. You just push the piston and then exhaust the steam into the atmosphere.
And the immediate benefit there is power density. A high-pressure engine was way more powerful for its size.
Oh, the difference was night and day. Watt's engines were slow, massive, stationary. Trevithick's high-pressure engine, patented in 1802, was compact, powerful, and it could move. It was the prerequisite for the steam locomotive, for steamships, for everything that came next.
And Trevithick also refined the pumping engine with the Cornish engine, didn't he?
He did, starting in the 1810s. This was a highly specialized compound cycle engine. It used high-pressure steam expansively first, and then condensed the lower-pressure exhaust steam. It was designed for heavy pumping duty and achieved efficiency that rivaled Watt's best work, but at much higher power levels.
Okay, so now we have the historical context. Let's turn to the mechanics. Let's tear the whole thing down. What are the essential physical components of a modern steam plant?
Well, you're going back to the Rankine cycle, which defines the four stages. First, you need a heat source and the conversion vessel, the boiler or steam generator.
And the engineering of the boiler itself saw a huge evolution, specifically in how heat was transferred. The sources distinguish between fire tube and water tube designs.
Yes. The fire tube boiler, which was common in early high-pressure engines and locomotives, works by passing hot combustion gases through tubes that are immersed in water. It's simple to make and holds a lot of steam, which is good for quick bursts of power.
But it had limits on pressure.
Exactly. The shell had to contain the pressure, which limited how high you could go.
Yeah.
The water tube boiler was the answer. Here, the water is inside a network of tubes, and the hot gases circulate around the outside. This means the pressure is contained by many small diameter tubes, which are inherently much stronger. They can handle vastly higher pressures and temperatures.
And to get maximum efficiency, you don't just want steam, you want better steam. Which brings us to superheating. What is that, and why is it so important?
Well, when water boils, the steam it produces often contains tiny suspended droplets of liquid water. We call that wet steam. Wet steam is inefficient, and it's destructive. It causes erosion, and, critically, it contributes to our old enemy, cylinder condensation.
So superheating is the fix for wet steam.
It is. After the steam leaves the main boiler drum, it's routed through a secondary set of tubes, the superheater, often placed in the hottest part of the furnace. This raises the steam temperature well above the boiling point without increasing the pressure. That extra heat turns all those water droplets into dry, invisible, high-energy superheated steam.
So we've generated our high-pressure superheated steam. Next, it moves to the motor unit, the piston, or the turbine. After it does its work there, what happens to it?
It moves to the final stage, the cold sink. The mechanism for rejecting waste heat. Every heat engine has to have this step. In the simplest case, like a steam locomotive, the cold sink was just the atmosphere.
Which is terribly inefficient, but very convenient.
Very convenient. Locomotives vented steam directly out. The clever trick there was venting some of that exhaust up the chimney through a nozzle, the blast pipe, which created a powerful suction, making the fire burn hotter. Great for power, terrible for efficiency. You lose all latent heat.
So for any static application or a ship where fuel weight matters, they had to recover that heat, which requires a condenser.
Absolutely. The goal of the condenser is to create a vacuum at the exhaust end, increasing the pressure difference across the piston, and to turn the steam back into liquid water for recirculation. The big innovation here was the surface condenser in the 1830s.
To avoid fouling the boiler with salt water, right?
Yeah, exactly. The surface condenser used tubes to pass cooling water through while the exhaust steam condensed on the outside of those tubes. This kept the pure boiler feed water completely separate from the cooling medium.
Okay, so we've got the full anatomy. But let's return to the elephant in the cylinder. That fundamental thermodynamic challenge of the simple reciprocating engine. The problem Watt solved, but which continued to plague engineers.
Right. Think about the inside of a single expansion cylinder. When the high-pressure steam enters, it expands and its temperature drops significantly, maybe hundreds of degrees, in a single stroke. The metal cylinder walls are exposed to this huge, instantaneous temperature drop.
So they end up at a temperature somewhere in the middle.
Yes. And when the fresh, hot, high-pressure steam comes in, it immediately hits these relatively cooler metal surfaces. A huge portion of that steam doesn't push the piston. It just immediately flashes back into liquid water condensation on the cylinder walls.
So you've just lost energy before the piston has even really started its stroke. That steam is now useless.
That's the major loss. But then there's the second half of the cycle. During the exhaust stroke, as the pressure falls, those water droplets on the walls flash back into steam. To do that, they draw heat directly from the cylinder walls, cooling them down even further.
So it's a thermodynamic self-sabotage. It's spending energy, cooling its own working surfaces right before it needs to reheat them.
Precisely. It's constantly stealing heat at the end of the stroke and wasting it. This is why just making a bigger cylinder for more expansion is counterproductive. More surface area means more condensation.
So the simple engine hit a thermal ceiling. The only logical solution was to change the configuration. This forced the leap to compound and multiple expansion engines.
This was the major refinement that kept the reciprocating engine viable for so long. The core idea is just elegant. Instead of one massive efficiency-killing temperature drop, you split the total drop across two, three, or even four cylinders in series.
So let's trace the path. High-pressure steam enters the first, smallest cylinder.
It starts in the high-pressure H-key cylinder. It expands, does work, and the temperature drops, but only moderately, so condensation is minimized. The exhaust steam from that HP cylinder is then routed directly into the next larger cylinder, the low-pressure LP cylinder, in a simple compound engine.
And the subsequent cylinders have to be progressively larger to handle the expanding steam volume.
Absolutely. The engine is staged. By keeping the temperature differential small in each cylinder, you drastically reduce condensation loss across the whole system.
And the ultimate expression of this was the triple and quadruple expansion engines. Where did these mechanical behemoths become mandatory?
Marine shipping. After 1880, they were basically universal for large ships. The efficiency gain was strategic. If you carry 30% less coal on a transatlantic voyage, that means 30% more cargo. The complexity was justified by the cost savings. We see the legacy of this design in the World War II Liberty ships, over 2,700 of them, all driven by reliable triple expansion steam engines.
Incredible. So let's shift to motion control. For an engine to be useful, especially for something like a locomotive, you need precise control over the piston cycle. Let's talk about the four events of the cycle.
Okay, so for every two strokes, you have four events. Admission, letting steam in, expansion, the power stroke, exhaust, venting the spent steam, and compression, trapping a bit of that spent steam as a cushion. And all of this is governed by the valve gear.
The primary way to control power and save steam was to shorten the cutoff. Explain what that means.
Shortening the cutoff just means closing the admission valve earlier in the stroke. This lets a smaller amount of high-pressure steam into the cylinder, but it lets that steam expand for a longer period. The benefit is huge. You use less steam per stroke for the same amount of work. It increases efficiency dramatically.
But early, simple valve gears had a major issue when you tried to do that.
Yes, because if you advance the valve to shorten admission, you also automatically shorten the exhaust period. If the exhaust period was too brief, the spent steam couldn't get out, which led to high compression and reduced power. It made the engine rough and inefficient.
So how did they solve this compromise? They introduced the concept of LAP.
LAP was the compromise that made simpler valve gears, like the ones in locomotives, work so well. LAP is basically an extension of the valve's surface, designed to overlap the admission port when the valve is in its middle position. By adding LAP, the valve has to move further before it opens the port, which shortens the admission period. But crucially, the geometry means the exhaust side of the valve stays open for longer.
Pure mechanical genius. A subtle change in geometry to fix a huge thermodynamic problem. And you mentioned compression. Why is that essential, not just a side effect?
Compression is vital for the mechanical health of the engine. Before the exhaust valve closes, a small bit of low-pressure steam is trapped. This steam is then compressed as the piston comes to the end of its stroke.
It acts like a cushion.
Exactly. A pneumatic dampener. It absorbs the momentum gently, avoiding the terrible mechanical shock of the piston slamming into the suddenly admitted high-pressure steam on the reversal.
And these are incredible levels of precision. How did engineers actually monitor these complex cycles?
That's where instrumentation became critical. The truly revolutionary diagnostic tool was the steam engine indicator. This instrument mechanically traces the pressure inside the cylinder throughout the entire cycle onto paper, generating what we call an indicator diagram.
What can you read from that diagram?
Everything. The shape tells you if the cutoff is too early, if the exhaust is restricted, if the compression is too high, and by calculating the area inside the diagram, they could precisely determine the developed horsepower. It was like an EKG for the engine.
And if the indicator showed you how good your engine was, the gold standard for stationary performance was the Corliss engine? What made George Corliss's 1849 design so special?
Corliss addressed the compromises of simpler valve gears. He used four separate rotary valves, two for admission, two for exhaust. That separation allowed him to optimize the timing for all four events independently. The exhaust valves could open and close quickly, minimizing back pressure. The admission valves could be instantly trip shut by a governor-controlled mechanism.
This allowed for automatic variable steam cutoff.
On a massive scale. If the load dropped, the governor would trigger the steam to be cut off much earlier in the stroke, running the engine highly expansively and maintaining the exact set speed. It used 30% less steam than competing designs. The Rumford Metal Committee called it the greatest mechanical invention since Watt's separate condenser.
It's fascinating how far they took the piston engine. But ultimately, for truly massive power output, they had to abandon reciprocating motion altogether.
And that leads us to the final and most enduring evolution, the steam turbine.
The turbine represents a complete rethinking. How does it work?
Well, a piston engine converts thermal energy into linear motion, which is then converted into rotary motion. The turbine converts thermal energy directly into rotary motion. It's built from a series of disc rotors with aerodynamically shaped blades alternating with fixed blade stators. The steam expands through these stages and its momentum and pressure act directly on the rotor blades, producing tremendous, smooth, continuous torque.
And that inherent rotational efficiency gave it massive advantages, especially for the emerging electric grid.
Oh, for output above a few hundred horsepower, the advantages are undeniable. Turbines are more efficient, have fewer moving parts, and provide an incredibly smooth rotational force, which is perfectly matched to the high RPMs needed by electric generators.
So that solved electricity generation.
It did. By the early 20th century, turbines had virtually replaced reciprocating engines in power stations. Today, it doesn't matter what the heat source is, coal, gas, nuclear. You're making steam and feeding it to a turbine. 90% of U.S. electricity relies on this process.
The other area it dominated was marine propulsion.
The transition was swift. HMS Dreadnought in 1905, the first major warship to use only steam turbines, signaled the end of the reciprocating engine in high-power naval vessels. They provided higher speed, better reliability, and less vibration.
So whether it's a locomotive or a nuclear reactor, success hinges on efficiency. We have to finish by drilling down into the Rankine cycle and why it's the king.
Modern efficiency is always compared against the theoretical maximum, the Carnot cycle. The Carnot limit tells you the best you can possibly do, based purely on the temperature difference between the hot side, the boiler, and the cold side, the condenser.
But the Carnot cycle, theoretically, requires compressing the working fluid while it's a gas.
Which is where the Rankine cycle provides the elegant, practical workaround. That is the core genius of the steam plant. The Rankine cycle works by forcing the working fluid to change phase. When the steam leaves the turbine, we collapse it into liquid water in the condenser. The crucial advantage is this. You pressurize the working fluid water when it is in its liquid phase using a pump.
And pumping a liquid takes dramatically less energy than compressing a gas.
An incredibly small amount. The pump work consumes only maybe 1% to 3% of the total power generated by the turbine. If you try to compress that steam back up to boiler pressure using a compressor, you'd consume maybe 30% to 50% of the energy you just generated. The minimal work input for the liquid pump is what makes the Rankine cycle so dominant.
That's the secret sauce. That's why modern plants can achieve thermal efficiencies in the mid-40% range.
Which is astronomical compared to the 1% to 10% of those early engines.
Finally, we need to touch on the inherent dangers and the safety measures developed to mitigate them.
A high-pressure boiler contains a massive amount of stored energy. A sudden failure can be catastrophic. So for centuries, engineers have relied on two independent safety mechanisms.
The first is the safety valve.
Right. It's designed to open and vent steam if the pressure exceeds a limit. Historically, these were simple lever and weight designs, which were easy to tamper with. Modern spring-loaded valves are tamper-proof.
And the second, more subtle mechanism is the fusible plug.
The fusible plug is a lead plug screwed into the firebox crown right over the hottest part of the furnace. If the water level drops too low, the plug is no longer cooled by water. Its temperature shoots up until the lead melts. The steam then rushes to the hole, making a loud whistling sound.
So it's not designed to prevent an overpressure explosion, but to prevent a low water temperature runaway.
Correct. It warns the operators that the firebox crown is dangerously exposed and risks buckling, which could lead to a massive explosion. It's a beautifully simple fail-safe mechanism.
We span two millennia in this deep dive. From Hero's Toy to Newcomen's Giant, Watt's Efficiency Leap, and the high-pressure mobility of Trevithick, we analyzed compound engines, advanced valve gears, and the Corliss masterpiece.
And we culminated with the steam turbine, which discarded the reciprocating mechanism but kept the core thermodynamic process, the Rankine cycle, intact, making it the bedrock of our modern electrical world.
The efficiency gains from the first pumps to today's turbines are truly staggering, transforming 99% waste into 45% utilized energy. The idea that a machine conceived to pump water from a mine has evolved into the indispensable infrastructure for the digital age is just astonishing.
It really speaks to the enduring powers of fundamental physics. The piston might be retired in many applications, but the principle of converting heat into pressurized steam and using that phase change for work, that remains the central engine of high-output power.
So, here's our final thought for you to chew on. The same foundational Rankine cycle that powers traditional coal and gas facilities is now the engine of choice for nuclear power and large-scale solar thermal facilities, where massive mirror rays focus sunlight to boil water. If the engine that defined the industrial age is now inextricably linked to the highest forms of non-fossil fuel energy technology, what unexpected clean energy legacy will this centuries-old thermodynamic principle create next? The steam engine is not a relic. It is the ultimate utility player in the energy game.